This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start with news breaking today. Boston Public Schools will delay its next phase of returning to classroom learning. 3, 4, and 5-year-old students were slated to return next week. That's now been pushed back to October 22nd at the earliest, according to Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Here's Mayor Walsh at a press conference announcing the decision earlier today.
I want to be absolutely clear. We will continue to ensure that our schools are prepared to protect the health and safety of our students, our teachers, and all of the people and any of the people that are in them.
So the move comes in response to Boston having an uptick in coronavirus cases. The positive test rate for last week was 4.1%. On the line to tell us more is WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. Hey there, Carrie.
Hi, Tiziana.
So tell us a little bit more about the decision, Carrie. What did the mayor say today?
Yeah, I mean, it sounded like there were a lot of factors that went into this. He said that seeing the city numbers tick up was definitely discouraging. And Mayor Walsh and the superintendent also re-upped several public health messages of, like, the importance of wearing masks and staying away from those large gatherings. And the important thing to note here, too, is that the district is not ending in-person instruction altogether. They are allowing the students that did already go back into buildings, and those are the students with high needs, like English learners, homeless students, and students with special needs. They can continue to go back because Walsh says that this student group really needs that in-person learning the most.
This decision came down to me realizing that our highest need students need the district as their choice. We are their chance for success to help them move forward.
The Boston Teachers Union has also posted a statement today saying that they do agree with this decision to delay that reopening process, although union leaders did continue to push for things like more air quality testing and facilities inspections, as they have been. This announcement is also part of the agreement that the district had with the union that after infection rates go above 4%, working in person becomes optional then for teachers.
So that raises a question. Was this an actual decision for the mayor and the district, or was this more of an automatic trigger, something automatically triggered due to that agreement?
I mean, it's hard to say for sure, but I mean, you know, that part of the agreement saying working from home or working in the building is now a choice for teachers, that was part of the official agreement, you know, and that was an MOU, so it was something that the district had to stick to. And so that could raise some potential problems, like depending on how many teachers do opt out of coming in, you know, that idea of increasing the amount of kids in the building could pose some staffing shortages. So I think that might have factored into this decision. And then also, you know, you have that guidance from the State Department of Education. Boston has been in their red category for a couple of weeks when it comes to infection rates. And that's at the point where they recommend that districts switch to in-person learning. So there were a couple of factors here.
Wait, I'm sorry. Recommend that they switch to in-person learning or remote learning?
In-person. No, you're right. I misspoke there, that they switch to remote learning only.
Okay, so that Wednesday today, next week is when this parents were planning on sending their kids to school. That's 5 days from now. So that's a lot of plan adjustment to make in a short period of time. Have you heard any parent reaction?
I mean, yeah, parents are definitely disappointed, especially the parents that did want to send their kids back. You know, there is part of part of the thinking is, you know, just wanting some kind of schedule to rely on, though. I mean, I think we've seen with how this pandemic has rolled out, it's got to be kind of a wait and see sort of thing. So in some senses, this wasn't, you know, totally out of left field. But parents of the kids who are already back say that they appreciate the district prioritizing kids with high needs. One of them was Roxanne Harvey, and she's the chair of Boston Special Education Parent Advisory Council. Here's what she said.
This opportunity to be back in school has changed our children. Just seeing them and start to open up and just these 2 days of being in school, it's almost like seeing different children.
So to that point, those kids are staying in school, as you've mentioned. How is the district squaring that? If it's not safe for other students to return, How are they talking about safety for the students who are staying?
Well, I mean, I think it's a matter of like balancing benefits and risks here. There are only about 1,300 kids back in the building right now. Those are the kids that, you know, can be listed under that high needs category. And so, you know, having that few kids in the building does reduce transmission risk. You know, the district as a whole is 55,000 students. So in comparison, spread out all of their buildings, there's not a lot of people in them at the moment. And the mayor and the superintendent also stress that they do have a lot of faith in how effective, you know, their new cleaning protocols are and how effective their, you know, mask policies are.
I noticed too, Carrie, that both the mayor and Superintendent Conselius talked about the other kinds of risks for these high-need students that can't be mitigated in the same way that COVID risks can be. So does that seem to be figuring into the calculus?
Yeah, I really think so. I mean, you know, one thing that was talked a lot about at the press conference was just, you know, the risk of regressing, especially when you know, there are skills that students have been working on for a really long time. And a lot of the high need students need, you know, pretty significant wraparound services. That's really hard for an individual parent or even individual family to have the skills to be able to do effectively. And so that was definitely part of the calculus.
Okay, so the announcement today was only for the students who are slated to return next week. There's another phase, which includes grades 1 through 3. That's scheduled for the 22nd and the 26th. So two questions. Could those phases be delayed as well? And has the district made any commitment about timelines by which it would make such decisions?
Outside of their, you know, sort of plan that they posted in the late summer about like, here's our goal of when we want to open, you know, they aren't really committing to anything. You know, Superintendent Brenda Caselius said that this pandemic is an evolving situation and, you know, she's making decisions as new information comes in. Here's how she described it.
We're all watching carefully the public health metrics to determine if this recent uptick is a trend or if we have to continue to evaluate our current plans and adjust those accordingly.
And one thing that Mayor Walsh also added was that if the city and the district and, you know, public health officials do determine that things are really unsafe for pretty much anyone to be in the building, he said he's not afraid to close the buildings again. So that is on the table. We just don't know exactly what might trigger that.
So Boston is the biggest school district in the state. Carrie, do you think other districts might follow suit or maybe have other districts made similar decisions already recently?
Yeah, I mean, in Framingham, there was a pretty significant uptick in COVID-19 cases there just recently, and they just announced that they are scaling back their plans to return to in-person learning. So I think, you know, as we see infection rates rise, this is something that more and more districts are turning to.
What's the biggest thing you're going to be watching for now, Carrie?
You know, I mean, it's just like these individual you know, what's the triggers that districts will be using to say, okay, we're closing completely, or, you know, those very specific things. I think it's really hard for districts to say right now, and I think there's definitely a push and pull from different stakeholders in regards to when they need to do that. So that's one thing we're keeping an eye out on and keeping close tabs on our desk.
All right, that's WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
President Trump caught members of both political parties off guard with a tweet last night announcing that he was ending negotiations over another coronavirus relief package. The tweet read in part, quote, "I have instructed my representatives to stop negotiating until after the election when, immediately after I win, we will pass a major stimulus bill that focuses on hardworking Americans and small business," end quote. Now, since then, the president has walked that language back a bit, suggesting he is open to smaller standalone bills, including relief for the airline industry or another round of individual stimulus checks. Well, we caught up with Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal earlier to get his reaction. He represents the 1st District and is chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. I started by asking what he made of the president's comments about shutting down negotiations.
Well, I think it's ill considered. I think the economic evidence and the health evidence are both overwhelming. And I think it's very clear that you want to remind the American people that until we defeat the virus, it's going to be hard to get to a pronounced economic recovery. Simple matter here is clear. people are going to need another round of stimulus checks. We're going to need another round of unemployment insurance with the supplemental $600 that we've proposed. Our hospitals are going to need more money as we proceed to perhaps a resurgence of the virus. The expansion of the retention tax credit would be important as well. And I think that on an overall basis, the advice that was offered by Jay Powell, not just yesterday, incidentally, but as the notes of what took place during the September meeting of the Federal Reserve Board, they painted a pretty ominous design on where we find ourselves. And I think that the president is ignoring the advice of healthcare people and economic people simultaneously.
Congressman, the president tweeted that he didn't feel the Democrats had been negotiating in good faith. Prior to this announcement, did you feel talks had been making progress?
The talks were making progress. The Ways and Means Committee, we did much of this work. I know exactly what the Speaker of the House offered in terms of the negotiation. Recall that the HEROES Act that we passed on May 15th of this year, at $3.4 trillion, was simultaneously compromised for the purpose of addressing on a shorter-term basis, obviously, but nonetheless getting that money into the hands of people who needed it. She moved from $3.4 trillion to $2.2 trillion. The administration moved from $1 trillion to $1.6 trillion. I could see, even if we had a shorter timetable, that that would be part of the compromised answer here. It made good sense all the way around. So I think the impetuous nature of the president's decision-making here reared its head once again. His devotion to the stock market, I think, probably has caused him to reverse the course again. And I think that an understanding here of what is going to be necessary for the American people, not just in terms of sustenance for the daily necessities of life, but also simultaneously creating demand. People are going to have trouble making rent payments. That means that the owners of properties are going to have trouble making mortgage payments, and that eventually will seep into problems in community banking and credit unions, who overwhelmingly are the originators of mortgages.
You just expressed concern about people being able to meet the daily necessities of life. It seems like the president was trying to carve out a win for himself. Later in a tweet, he said, quote, "If I am sent a standalone bill for stimulus checks, parentheses $1,200, they will go out to our great people immediately. I am ready to sign right now. Are you listening, Nancy?" End quote. Is there an outcome where the Democrats deal with the president just on the stimulus checks before the election and take up the rest later?
Well, I think that what we need is a broader package here, and I think unemployment insurance has to be part of it, and I think that more money for our hospitals will have to be part of it, and the retention tax credit is going to have to be part of it. But where the Speaker and I helped design this package, where we came to the conclusion on the timetable was very simple. Rather than a year, we would take this into the end of January and then take a look at what the economy and the healthcare situation looked like then. So, again, there's room here for compromise. I think the president has mistaken the position he took yesterday for the one he's already offering today. People do need that stimulus check, and they're going to need the supplemental as well.
When we talked in July, you expressed some real optimism that more relief would be coming. Right now, what we're talking about is a question of timing, and that matters, as you say, because people are hurting now. But do you maintain optimism that the package of types of relief that people need can be negotiated with the Senate and signed?
I do, and I want to point something out that I think is essential. The CARES Act, which was overwhelmingly written by the Ways and Means Committee, saved the American economy. And the reason we were able to stabilize the COVID virus epidemic at that time was because of the infusion of money that we put into hospitals and testing. So you're going to need another round of money for testing as well. So I think that, again, the miscalculation at the White House, which incidentally should be is focused on one person, Secretary Mnuchin, I know, and based on conversations, he has repeatedly warned that you need an infusion of cash for purposes of liquidity into the system now.
So you've mentioned some members of the president's cabinet there. I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to ask you, how are you feeling in this moment about the level of functioning of our executive branch? Do you have concerns about the number of people with coronavirus diagnoses, the ability to coordinate when so many people have to be remote? You expressed some dismay over the president's attitude over the last 24 hours. How are you thinking about all of that?
I think that one of the most important jobs that the president has, any president for that matter, is in the arena of reassurance. Assuring the American people of stability and confidence and imbuing the system with optimism strikes me as one of the most earnest responsibilities that any president has. In this case here, it's the chaotic nature of tweeting on a daily basis. So yesterday, the stock market dropped by 1.4%. This morning, the stock market's up by 1.2%. And I think that this is not healthy in terms of trying to stem the tide of the virus. I think that the infatuation that the White House has with the stock market, or at least one person at the White House has with the stock market, is, again, not well thought out.
So given that you've been in conversations with other parts of the administration, any thought that there's a coalition that could be formed to convince the president to change course here and get a bill signed soon that satisfies enough of all the interested parties?
I think the compromise here is very obvious, and that is we shorten the duration of our plan, taking it to the end of January on the Democratic side, and they up the offer that they have on their side from $1.6 trillion to closer to $2.2 trillion, an acknowledgement that you need unemployment insurance extensions, you're going to need retention tax credit expansion, you're going to need money for our hospitals, you're going to need money for the stimulus checks that are going to be sent to people with the supplement, and everybody agrees on the nature of the challenge and the problem. The difficulty is that even I think most members of the administration agree, certainly Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, who I don't think you would describe him as a liberal Democrat. He is the one that is forewarned about the necessity of getting this money into the hands of people who need it. And I think that that advice is really sound.
The work of the government is continuing. Are there new safety precautions being taken in Congress now that there is an outbreak in D.C. in the administration? And are you thinking and are committees thinking about those things differently now?
Well, I think that in terms of precaution, I think that you can see the changes that have taken place, how the floor is actually managed. Those of us who've had the experience previously of voting at 15-minute intervals once the clock ticks down, we now find that the most routine vote can take up to an hour. And that's based upon the fact that alphabetically members are called to the House for the purpose of casting a vote and then urged to get off the floor swiftly. So the committee work that takes place, which I oversee on the Ways and Means Committee, we do that now all virtually by Zoom. And so the engagement has changed. There's no question about that. We've had a couple of chances to at least sporadically meet, but social distancing is adhered to, and I think face masks are worn. But the whole nature of engagement and interaction has substantially changed.
Last question for you, Congressman. We're less than a month away from the election, and we know the president has continued to question the integrity of that election. He did it during the debate with Vice President Joe Biden last week. Do you have a message to American voters and voters in the Commonwealth about the election?
Well, I think that the stability of our elections, based upon the idea that we can predict on a quadrennial basis that our election is going to take place on the first Tuesday after the first Monday, is essential to our functioning democracy. And despite the fact that the president has called attention to what he believes to be the inadequacies of voting by mail, he's simply mistaken. Up to 40% of the votes in this election are going to be cast by mail-in voters. You can see what happened to the turnout here in Massachusetts during the primary because people were able to exercise the use of mail-in voting. It was transformative. The numbers went way up. And I'm confident we're going to inaugurate a president on January 20th, despite what this president says.
And that is Congressman Richard Neal. He represents Massachusetts' 1st District and is chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. Congressman Neal, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate you joining us.
Great to talk to you. All the best. Bye-bye.
Almost one quarter. That, according to the Massachusetts Restaurant Association, is the number of restaurants and eateries that have closed permanently due to the economic impact of the pandemic. Seems like every couple days, a new location says it's closing. This week, it's Kinsale, the Asgard, and the Stoddard so far. For the restaurants that have reopened, a new challenge, how to stay in business, keep staff safe, keep patrons safe when winter hits. Well, joining us now are two restaurateurs, I have trouble saying that word, two restaurant owners who are now facing exactly these tough decisions. Heather Mosier is the co-owner of State Park, Mamala's Deli, and Café du Pays, all in Cambridge. Heather, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Irene Lee, owner and head chef of the Maymay Restaurant Group in Boston. Irene, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Listeners, we want to invite you to join this conversation. Pull up a chair. Have you lost a favorite local eatery? Have you returned to indoor dining? Are you going to do that? Do you have concerns about the winter? And what place are you worried about and want to help keep open? We also would love to hear from you if you're listening and you're a local restaurant owner. What's going on for you? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Heather and Irene, I just want to start by checking in with you. Heather, wow, it has been a rough several months for everyone. How are you holding up?
It's okay. We've got the three different restaurants, and they each are on their own path. So we, you know, can get distracted by the winds of the high holidays at Mamala's, for example. That was an extremely busy time for the deli. Over at Cafe du Pays, we have pivoted the concept to a corner grocery called Vincent's, and that's been going since the springtime, offering grocery items and takeout food, cocktails, wine and beer to the neighborhood and the folks who work around the Kendall area. And State Park opened later in August, and that's mostly on-premise dining on our big patio that was just recently renovated. So all three restaurants definitely are keeping us busy, but overall it's a slower pace of business. And personally, I have an 11-month-old baby, so he's able to actually come to work with me, which I probably actually definitely wouldn't have been able to do if we were operating at full speed. That wouldn't be appropriate. But now at this lower, slower pace, I got my baby with me, or if he's not with me, he's with my husband over at Vincent's.
Well, first, Heather, congratulations on the new baby. That's fabulous. Irene, how are you doing personally?
Oh, boy. Well, I think on average, I'm hanging in there. There are good days and bad days, and things at May May have been changing rapidly and nonstop over the last couple months.
And how are you processing as a business owner, a community member, a neighbor, a family member? How are you just sort of putting one foot in front of the other? We get such interesting answers from the people that we speak with across all kinds of professions and worlds just because we're in such an unusual time.
Yeah, I think the challenge of this time for me and maybe for other folks is that we do really try to put our heads down and kind of grind it out. I think in the restaurant industry, we are accustomed to being able to throw more hours at a problem and thereby solve it. And we're in a position now where more work and more stress is not necessarily going to get us any farther. I think that for me, you know, the announcement we made regarding May May last week was really about letting go of the idea of May May as it used to be as a restaurant in a traditional sense and saying, you know, May May is going to live on, but it's going to look different and it's probably not a restaurant anymore.
Heather, what is your reaction to hearing Irene say that about her restaurant, about May May?
I think that it makes total sense, and I think we're going to see that from other concepts, too. We've been toying with the idea of closing the dining room permanently at Mamala's. We are finding a stride with the type of service that we're doing over there, and even with our location at Time Out Market, it's kind of along those lines where we operate a kitchen and some counter service, but it kind of stops there. And so I don't know if this will proliferate more restaurants taking the fast casual or quick service route, but I wouldn't be surprised if it did.
Irene, I read your announcement last week and I listened to you talk about it just here. You are being very professional, very matter of fact about it. How hard was that decision to make?
Well, in a lot of ways, it was gut-wrenching But in other ways, it is kind of the logical conclusion of this path that we've been on. I don't think that makes it any easier emotionally. But since the beginning of the pandemic, we have said at Maymay that we're not going back to any kind of on-site dining until there's a vaccine. And so while there's been, for me, like a coming to terms process, I think it is exactly kind of what we committed to in the first place in terms of, you know, what lines we felt we weren't going to be able to cross.
I want to grab a call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Cheryl is on the line from Roxbury. Cheryl, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Strotter. I own Soleil Restaurant. And like many of my colleagues who are restaurant owners, this is a challenging time. And we also had to make a pivot as far as our dine-in is concerned. We are in the headquarters of the Boston School Department, and with so many administrators working from home, our revenue has declined. So what we are doing is leaning more on the takeout concept and family meals so folks can come in, buy in bulk, and take it back home. Because the dine-in that we are so accustomed to and so enjoyed for years has changed tremendously, and it's going to be this way for quite some time.
Thank you for that call, Cheryl. Heather, let me give you a chance to react to Cheryl there.
I think she's right. It seems like we know that restaurants are risky behavior. Indoor dining in restaurants is a risky behavior. And so to pivot with family meals, like she said, and other sorts of takeout or even packaged goods for a sale at a farmer's market or collaborations with other local businesses for pickup and drop-off sites, it's kind of a bright spot in this really difficult time, all the new ideas that are coming from it.
You know, one of the things that was intriguing in talking to both of you is your feelings about the safety of in-restaurant dining, in-person dining, kind of regardless of where the state is on allowing it. You both, you know, have expressed reservations about that. You know, and it raises questions about responsibilities of patrons, responsibilities of the state, responsibilities of the restaurant industry. Do you feel disproportionately burdened in having to make these pivoting decisions for your businesses when the state is in a different place on it? Irene, maybe you can go first.
Yeah, I think what's hardest for me, not just as a restaurant owner, but also as a diner and someone who really loves restaurants, is that there's not consistent guidance. And so restaurant owners are in the position of trying to decide what is safest for us and for our teams and for our broader community. And, you know, both my parents were doctors, but I'm not an epidemiologist. And so I think one of the things that has been frustrating is the lack of leadership at so many levels. And also we understand that diners are getting really mixed messages about what's okay and about what they should do and about how they can save the restaurant industry. And frankly, at this point, you know, I think that only the bailout is going to save our industry, or at least the parts of it that are small and independent that diners like me love the most. And so I certainly have a lot of feelings about that.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Irene. I mean, in this segment before we joined the two of you, we were, you know, playing the conversation I had earlier today with House Ways and Means Chair Richard Neal, talking about the fact that the president has ceased all negotiations on another coronavirus package. You know, as a business owner who was looking forward to that, Heather, you know, how does that news make you feel? And how heavily were you planning on, on the federal government providing that money to be able to keep putting one foot in front of the other?
We've been pamphleting our takeout bags pretty heavily and talking with our customers one-on-one when they come to the window and ask how they can help. We have been sharing the Independent Restaurant Coalition's work to petition their representatives about this. And so when the Restaurants Act was included in the Heroes Act, we were thrilled because we were pretty certain that that was one of the only ways that we were going to make it through, that and help from landlords. And I think that's probably the deal for most restaurants, is it's a little bit from the landlord and a little bit from the federal government. So it was really disappointing. Yeah.
I want to grab a call on this. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What's the restaurant you're most anxious about in your community? If you're a restaurateur, what changes have you had to make? We've got Eric on the line from Jamaica Plain. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, I guess my, it's more of a comment, but looking toward the future, you know, I'm just kind of concerned about what the restaurant and food landscape looks like in Boston and around the country. It just feels like the chains are going to be able to prevail through this because they have the most money. And it just seems like it's just going to homogenize the food landscape. You know, just every place you go in the United States, just having the same food. And, you know, that's kind of concerning for me. I really hope that, you know, we can preserve sort of our restaurants and our food culture in Boston. It's more of a comment, so.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate that. Yeah, and let's turn to both Heather and Irene about that. Talk about what's happening to use Eric's words, our food culture in Boston during this pandemic, and what the tail of that is going to look like, you know, when we finally do, for example, have a vaccine. How are you thinking about that, either of you?
I think in the short term, I think Eric's absolutely right. I think chains are going to win out over independent restaurants because they have the bargaining power to come up with better deals with landlords, or, you know, they just have more money to throw at a pivot compared to an independent restaurant. I think it's going to proliferate quick serve restaurants, which isn't a bad thing, but I think it's going to just be a better climate for chains like Chipotle, for instance. I think that's more of a short-term issue. I think long-term, we might actually see a shakeup that allows for a more sustainable rent climate for small businesses, you know, maybe within the next 5 years, unless, of course, those chains have taken up all the real estate. But it could be an opportunity for small businesses to get in at a different type of lease agreement.
Irene, how big is rent in this picture? And of course, I welcome you to build on anything else Heather said as well. But the rent thing really struck me.
Yes. Well, for us, rent has been tremendous. We've been in active negotiations with our landlord, but so far we have been on the hook for our full rent. I think that, you know, to Eric's question, or his comment rather, certainly, we should be looking not just at which restaurants are closing, but what restaurants are opening in their places. We should be looking at who's developing property and what kind of businesses they're opening on them. I think Heather puts forth an optimistic picture that I very much believe in as well. Many, you know, immigrant-owned restaurants, more neighborhood restaurants that, you know, you're not seeing on social media, maybe they haven't been able to access PPP funds. If they relied on takeout and delivery primarily prior to the pandemic, like, some of these businesses are kind of doing awesome because they're able to really lean in on what they're best at. My favorite Indian restaurant is, I think, doing more takeout than ever before. So I am hopeful that someone's going to come out on top. And if it's not the chains, then I will be very happy.
It's interesting to hear the two of you talk about this note of optimism. I have to admit that both in preparing for our conversation today and in the first half of the conversation talking with you, I was feeling so sad. I mean, these are your talents. This is your legacy. This is what you share with the world. And we're using this term pivot, but it is massive change in how you chose to be in the world and what you chose to produce in the world. So it's encouraging to hear that optimism. And I wonder if you feel like you personally are pivoting or growing or changing as a result of this as well. Heather.
I have been able to adjust my work-life balance a little bit. It might be forced somewhat because of the baby, but I think all of my business partners, as well as me and my husband, we've been able to take days off when we're supposed to, for the most part, and work slightly fewer hours than in the past. We've been able to celebrate, you know, distanced backyard birthdays and, you know, be able to be a part of our families a little bit more than we have been in the past 10 years.
And Irene, how about you? Especially, you know, the Maymay Restaurant Group, that came out of your family. I mean, this has been part of family for you.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's a big adjustment and it's a lot to take in. Part of our story, or my story at least, has always been like, I never thought that I would be owning a restaurant. I thought that I would be doing some other kind of work. And so in a sense, you know, in a few months, maybe I'll wake up and say like, oh, you know, it was kind of all a dream. And now we're pivoting and we're doing something else. But all that being said, I think that this time has taught me how important it is to balance, kind of as you're saying, hope and realism, and how to have patience and let go of things that we can't control, because so much of restaurants is about attention to detail, dialing things in, and, you know, being able to work hard for an outcome that you want. And now we're in a situation where for a lot of people, that's just not possible.
Well, I tell you, I wish nothing but the best for the both of you. That's Irene Lee, the co-owner and head chef of the Maymay Restaurant Group in Boston. Irene, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Heather Mosier, the co-owner of State Park, Mamala's Deli, and Cafe Dupay, all in Cambridge. Heather, thanks to you as well.
Glad I could do it.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Engineering today is by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.